something we need to keep in balance as we're going through our policies, that we, a 10 or 20 or 50% increase, like we've seen some bills that have moved through here could do. We just got to remember there's 183,000 people already having a hard time paying their energy bill.
Thank you, Representative Westrum. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to I wanted a clarification on the prices. We talk about it a lot here, and I think we get confused sometimes about rates and ultimate costs if we're using less energy at a slightly higher rate. But you actually, in your testimony, you said the opposite. The price was less, but the costs were higher. Is that because it was colder or more energy was used? You see, you're nodding, it was colder. That was the...
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
Representative Breimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Walker, I'm wondering if, can you tell me, is there any money in the state budget for, at this point, for heating assistance?
Mr. Chair and Representative Reinhart, for the end of, I think it would be our fiscal year ending. I think that's correct.
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair and Representative, if I understood the question, is there currently a state funding for this program? No.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Walker.
Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chair.
The bill will be laid all over for possible inclusion.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Members, House File 1453 is next on the agenda, but since our vice chair is about to be called away to present a bill on another committee, I think we'll delay consideration of that bill until she's back with us in a reliable way. So
could be a while, Mr. Chair.
Could be, Representative Hoppe. We'll just skip the second item and go to House File 1645. Representative Bly.
Yes, I'm Representative Bly, and I'd like to move for consideration the omnibus bill of the Energy Committee, House File 1645, and I do have an amendment.
Is the amendment in the packet?
It's H1645A1. It should be in the packet.
Representative Black, you want to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order you'd like it to be considered?
Yes, I'd like to move the H1645A1 amendment to the bill to get the bill in the shape that I would like to move it in.
All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Then to your bill, Representative Black.
This is a bill for the affordability program, and it accomplishes two things. It requires the PUC to consider affordability of energy when setting rates, and requires investor-owned gas companies and permit investor-owned electric companies to establish affordability programs. The major components are applies to low-income customers, those receiving energy assistance. It requires customer to make the maximum payment customer can afford, given the customer's financial circumstances. The program makes up shortfall between customers' payments, energy assistance, and the full bill. The major benefits of this program maximizes revenues to the utilities. Customers pay regularly and on time. It mitigates arrears and bad debt by breaking disconnect and reconnect cycle. It lowers or eliminates utility collection costs and keeps customers connected to the system, preserving energy stability for families. And I do have Pam Marshall, who will offer some testimony.
Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. for a lot of the same reasons as I spoke in favor of the last bill, we're also supporting this bill. This bill was actually included as part of the Energy Omnibus bill last year, and again, several stakeholders worked to produce what is now, a consensus proposal. These programs, as Representative Bly indicated, are designed to supplement the funds that are available from the federal LIHEAP program. And we need that supplement because actually the over half of the Minnesota's energy assistance population lives well below the income guidelines, eligibility guidelines for energy assistance. In fact, they live below 100% of the federal poverty level. At that level of income, and some of these numbers are included in the packet that members have, but at that level of income, those households are spending an average of 16%, devoting 16% of their household income to energy costs. These energy burdens are unsustainable, and we think that's why LIHEAP customers are disproportionately represented in residential customer service disconnections. For example, LIHEAP customers account for less than 4% of all Xcel's residential customer base, but experience 15% of all of the service disconnections. Targeting affordability programs to customers with the least ability to pay can interrupt those cycles of service disconnection and reconnection and lower the costs associated with doing so. The programs are also designed to supplement LIHEAP because they stretch federal resources. That half of the population of Minnesota's LIHEAP households that live at or below the federal poverty level required 57% of the available crisis financial assistance. Last year, that meant that $6 million of federal money was spent just on emergency situations to avert service disconnections. Because under an affordability program, customers are only required to pay a certain percentage of their income, typically 6% for gas bills, they're better able to pay those bills and pay them more frequently, and therefore those federal crisis dollars are freed up to assist other households. Recently, a CenterPoint affordability program was approved by the Public Utilities Commission, and Xcel Gas has a proposal to do the same. At this point, just to clarify, the bill does limit the affordability programs to investor-owned natural gas utilities. These programs are not unusual. Nationwide now, utility-sponsored affordability programs in aggregate actually exceed the federal appropriation for the LIHEAP program, and we urge your support for this bill.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I've heard this before, and I know I should know this, and I'm not sure if Mr. Elwood or someone else can tell us or somebody from Xcel, but when we look at the bill, line 1.8 and subdivision 15, when it says the commission must consider ability to pay, and currently it says may. Maybe if we could have someone explain a little bit what the impact is on ratepayers in as a group or by classes or however. I'm not really sure how to ask that.
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, rate case.
Mr. Elwood, would you please?
Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, sorry. Currently a rate case, the consideration of how rates are set is extraordinarily complex, and there are many, many, many factors that go into that. Obviously, the utilities cost of service, primarily, and the cost of bad debt, and et cetera. Many, many, many factors, which currently must be considered. The fact that we're changing the may to must simply means that the price of energy is yet another consideration that the commission must put in the mix when they're determining the final outcome and what the actual rate's going to be. It's just one of the myriad of factors that they have to consider. Because we think that's important because as the price of energy escalates, and as we've heard the dramatic recent increases, I think it's risen to the point where affordability becomes a factor that should be one of those that the commission has to look at the end of the day when the soup is made and the price is set. And so I think that's the long and short of what this actually means.
Representative Hahn.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Elwood, I guess what I'm wondering, if we say the commission must consider ability to pay, is the desire of the legislation to establish affordability programs and to have different classes of rates or different rates?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, you know, again, this is amending existing law. So the original law was aimed exclusively at Xcel Electricity. It was originally a discount program, and this language was in the original statute. So if you're suggesting that perhaps it may more accurately belong in a different section of law, I might not disagree with you, but we're just simply amending current law and trying to make, as we usually do, try to make things as simple as possible. So this is where it was. This is where we're keeping it.
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I might also take a stab at your question. The made a must change, in my opinion, more accurately reflects that the commission has considered ability to pay as a factor in several of the most recent rate cases. And I think the reason the may establish affordability programs follows that must is that that's one way to address the consideration of ability to pay.
Representative Hoppe.
Last quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask this question a lot. I'm just wondering if, I'm guessing as a business practice, that the utilities probably already consider that as one of the many factors, and I'm just wondering if the legislation is necessary just to change may to must, or is that already being taken care of?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do believe that the legislation or the legislature should determine that this is our state policy, that we do need to consider the impact of increasing utility rates on residential ratepayers and in particular on low and fixed income ratepayers, and that it is the legislature should declare that policy and give that guidance to the commission.
Representative Hoppe.
You know, it's your decision, I guess, but I'm wondering, and maybe the answer is no, but I wonder if we want to hear from Xcel on this and find out if it's something they're already doing.
It was my intention to ask if anyone wanted to testify for or against this bill, and perhaps this would be an appropriate time to do that. So does anyone wish to testify for or against this bill? McCarran, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Grani McCarran with Xcel Energy. Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, Xcel is not opposed to the change in the made a must. Thank you for your consideration. I think, as has been said in the testimony, it's one of many factors that already is being considered, and we don't think that it unduly restricts the commission to consider all the other factors as well.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank
you. Mr. Chair, I was thinking about adjourning early.
Well, we always think about that. The thought that's constantly in my mind. Anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Representative Bly, was your motion to hold to lay the bill over for possible inclusion?
Is that correct? Sorry.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The Senate committee that heard this bill heard it yesterday and sent it directly to the floor. So
I could certainly do that.
Obviously your call. I just wanted you to know that information.
It's actually the author's call if he wishes to make that motion. Revise his motion.
I'll revise my motion on behalf of the... Yes.
So the motion then would be that House File 1645 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion fails.
Sorry about that.
Next on the agenda. Representative Johnson, House File 1679.
Was it possible to get over? Or
Representative Hackbarth, the question was about the Walker bill. That's a, that does have a funding component. We are holding that. Representative Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here on behalf of 1679, and I'd like to move this bill to pass once I get a chance to amend it and move it to the general register.
would you like to take up the amendment at this time?
Yes, if I may.
Johnson.
I have an amendment, H1679A1, that I'd like to move.
Representative Johnson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he wants it to be considered. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson.
Essentially what the amendment does, members, if you have a chance to look at the bill, it deletes Section 1 and Section 3, so we're only dealing with Section 2, which is directed towards undercharges. And this bill is aimed at utility undercharges. It's my understanding it's non-controversial, and Ron Elwood will just briefly explain what that entails.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you again for the opportunity to talk on this bill. And before I do, I think I'd like to just mention, with respect to all of the bills you're hearing today, I would really like to genuinely thank all of the utility companies that we've dealt with here in the state, Xcel, CenterPoint, Otter Tail, Minnesota Power, Merck, and the munis and co-ops, because it's been really delightful to be able to sit down with all those folks and have a discussion on these issues that are so important to us and obviously of importance to them too, and to get to a point where we can come to the table here with non-controversial bills, and we really appreciate their help on all of this. And so I want to make that absolutely clear and thank them publicly. And one of the things, I mean, in that vein, one of the things we did, the Sections 1 and 3 just seemed to have some problems that we weren't able to get through, and it just seemed that we'll just table those, work through the interim, and now we're left with Section 2. And this came to us because of several complaints we've received, and the bill does two things. The first thing we've had some problems with is, under current law, if you've been undercharged because of no fault of your own, so the meter was faulty or something happened and you just weren't charged enough, most people have no idea that they're either undercharged or overcharged, but they do have a sense sometimes that something's wrong. So if, for example, the undercharge took place over a period of 6 months, you weren't charged enough, and they discover it, well, then you get a honking big bill to pay that back. Well, under current law, you're able to pay the undercharge back over the same period that the undercharge occurred. So you'd have 6 months to pay it back. Well, a lot of our clients have found that when they get the bill, that six-month period just isn't enough time. They just can't, you know, if you divide that up, you divide the total of the bill by the 6 months, they just can't make those payments. So what this bill simply does is allow consideration of the customer's financial circumstances if you're at or below 50% of state means. So if you're poor, you get a little chance to pay it off a little longer. The second issue that we've found is that some of our clients have made complaints that I think my bill is wrong, and a couple utilities, they thank you, and then they took a couple of months to investigate. But the problem is the clock is ticking all along, so the undercharges are building up and the repayments are getting even higher. So what this bill simply says is requiring a timely investigation of a complaint so that they can make sure that the amount they have to repay is as little as possible. And that's the bill.
Any questions for the author or his witness? Seeing none. Anyone want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1679 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails.
Chair.
Representative Saylor, House File 1770.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move this bill to go to the General Register. And I do have an amendment.
Well, we're all sorting through the A1 amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Do you wish to move the amendment?
I do. I promise to move that, the A1 amendment at this time.
Representative Saylor moves the A1 amendment to get her bill in the form that she would wish it to be considered. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Saylor to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is pretty much a cleanup bill of some language. Basically, it clarifies that reconnections as well as disconnections are covered with regard to the cold weather rule. It also eliminates the requirement to declare inability to pay. And there are some other just common sense changes here, additional prohibitions on a disconnection that were added to the law, and this was agreed upon by the co-ops and the munis as well, and it provides for no disconnects while a complaint is pending, no disconnects on Friday unless there's been contact with the customer, no disconnects on Saturday, Sunday, or holiday, which is basically what's been happening anyway, but this just puts it in law. And no disconnects when offices are closed and no one is available to negotiate payment. And I would just turn it over to Mr. Elwood at this point for any further comments.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank Representative Saylor for bringing this bill forward. We have been working with the municipals and co-ops on this bill, and we really appreciate, again, their cooperation and getting to a point where we think that we've made necessary changes to the law, but that are not seen as burdensome on the companies. I think Representative Saylor summed up the bill beautifully, but I think one point I'd like to bring your attention to is on page 2, lines 20 to 23. One of the things we've added at when in discussions with the companies, if we've got a field personnel person going out to effect the disconnect, and again, there is some misconception that you cannot be disconnected during the wintertime. That's not true. If you don't make your payment, you can be. And so if that has to happen, and the company is sending out a field person, some of the service territories are rather large. So if they're driving a couple of 3 hours and then they get to the house and it's after 5 o'clock and the office is closed, it just seemed like that's a wasteful cost. And one of the things we put in this bill was to say that the disconnection can continue provided that the field person makes the offer for the payment agreement, has the ability and authorization to enter into one, and to essentially stay the disconnect if the person is willing to do that. So in other words, since there's nobody back in the office to call, the field personnel steps in the shoes. So we thought that was a very reasonable amendment, and I think it's a good addition to the bill. And with that, stand for questions.
Any questions for Representative Saylor or Mr. Elwood? anyone wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no questions and no further testimony, Representative Saylor renews her motion that House File 1770 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Gunther, just in the nick of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for not being here in the committee, but I'm in too many places at the same time today, I'm afraid. But I will move House File 1544 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Great.
And this bill asks for $6 million to be appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Commerce for the biennium ending 6/30/2009 for the purpose of repurchasing propane as part of the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, commonly referred to as LIHEAP. And because I have two wonderful experts here, I will let them continue.
Just one more second. Which expert shall we call on first? Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, we understand this. Pam Marshall. I've been here half. This is a way to stretch resources, and we all know they're limited. I just want to point out a couple things about population that the LIHEAP population that heats with propane. Over 19% of the households last year that did receive assistance did so to help pay for propane bills. With no consumer protections against winter service disconnections for unregulated fuels, including propane, these households are the most vulnerable to fuel price increases and the cuts in energy assistance. While much of the recent price increase attention has been focused on natural gas, propane costs actually increased more this year over last year, a 32% increase from last year on top of already historically high prices. 5 years ago, a LIHEAP grant helped the household to purchase about 38% of the propane needed for a winter season, and now that same grant can purchase 26% of the fuel required to heat with propane. With pre-buy propane dollars, we can buy in bulk and lock in at the lowest possible price. Households, therefore, can use their energy assistance grant goes further. They can purchase more fuel with those grants because they are doing so then at lower than the current retail rates. I personally locked in at pre-buy at $1.79 a gallon in August, and the price today is $1.99, and historically that swing has been much more pronounced. We estimate conservatively that a pre-buy could have saved the energy assistance program about $4 million over the last several years. And we believe this appropriation bolsters the effectiveness of the energy assistance program, and we urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner for Energy and Telecommunications at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. One of the responsibilities that I have is to oversee the state's low-income heating energy assistance program. This year to date, we have received just under $77.5 million for energy assistance. Most of that goes into those in financial need to pay for their energy bills. We will be out of that money in the next 2 weeks. And the situation that we have is when you to do pre-buy, you need to have cash on hand in the summertime to be able to do the pre-buy for the coming winter. which always puts us in a very awkward situation because, as you've heard in previous testimony on previous bills, there's always more households that need and want and can use the aid than we have resources. And so as a rule, we do not reserve and hold back any funds, even though we have a considerable amount, because we want to serve the population in the time of need. What Representative Gunther's bill does is specifically allocate money to the Department of Commerce for the specific purposes of having us have the cash on hand so we can make the pre-purchase in the summertime for the coming winter. And it addresses an issue that we're not able to address ourselves because of that situation that I just explained.
Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garvey. Last year was, I believe, the first year you did pre-buy. Did we hit the low spot in the market? Did we buy more propane than we could have bought in the fall or winter? How did that run go?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
Mr. Garvey,
Representative Westrom. You're correct, Representative Westrom, that we were able to do pre-buy, and we bought just under $4 million worth of propane on January 11th. We were able to have that money available to us because the United States Congress made a distribution to the state of Minnesota of $28 million in the very end of March. So we were able to actually hold back some money for pre-buy, which was consistent with many of your legislative intent. It was in a bill that wasn't able to make it to passage, but we recognized the intent and we recognized the policy behind it. So we did go ahead and do a pre-buy exercise this past summer. We implemented it in a way that where we bought that just under $4 million worth of propane on July 11th. And then basically the heart of summer. Because propane prices, like many fuels, is becoming increasingly volatile, it's very, very hard to properly time the market. As the winter heating season came upon us last fall into today, it turned out that some of the times we purchased, some of the pre-bought pricing was higher than that market, most of it was lower. And so we did help many and extend the dollars, but I can't say we hit it perfectly all the time because of the volatility of the marketplace.
So,
Representative Western.
So prices today are higher than what they were last summer, even though last summer was a higher market than maybe historical averages, it still bought us more, or do you feel we maybe didn't buy any more, and it's a speculative business that's hard to hit on the head?
Representative Gunther, you're serious.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Westrom, this was not a typical year. This was very abnormal. Traditionally, the difference between the highs and the lows would have been much more pronounced. So this was one of the concerns of the Department of Commerce, that they would buy it at the absolute low. And I told them that when you purchase propane on an average year, there's going to be a pronounced difference when you purchase pre-buy it in the summer. And I think anybody that buys propane can agree with that. But this was not a typical year, so the difference wasn't as pronounced as it normally would have been.
Ms. Marshall?
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, I think it's also instructive to note that there was quite the range on July 11th in the price per gallon of propane, from an average low of about $1.40 a gallon to an average high of $2.20 a gallon. And It seems to me that will quickly erode any savings. And I think it's also true that learning as we go along, this is the first year in a while that pre-buy has been done, but it is not the first time that we pre-purchased propane with energy assistance dollars. And in those few years that we did it prior to about a four-year hiatus, we were saving significant amounts of money. Granted, it's tougher when the difference between the per gallon price in the summer and the winter, that gap is narrowing, but there were significant savings from those years before that we did it. And it's also, I think, important to know we could structure this so that because it's only a portion of the aggregate energy assistance households propane use that we're purchasing, we could release those funds later in the year, January and February, and better capture the savings from the demand in the winter, and not do it just as a first come, first serve earlier in the fall when that fluctuation is not likely to be as pronounced.
Representative Welty, Representative Western, are you?
I'm done.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty, and to Representative Gunther, I just want to thank you for bringing forward this bill as someone who represents a number of people who buy propane and heat their homes with propane and have the propane tank sitting outside. I know a lot of people take advantage of the pre-purchase, and a lot of people know that in a typical summer you can get it cheaper than what it's going to be at the winter, and we've seen some spikes in the past, and we could see that the cost in the winter was going to be extremely high, and I know the pre-purchase has been very financially beneficial for many residents. So I know there's going to be some risk involved, but I trust that the Department of Commerce and others will do their job in trying to get the lowest possible price.
Commissioner Garvey, could you address the budgetary issue here? What is the net effect of the $6 million from the general fund that this bill calls for? Should I ask Mr. Soderberg?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
are we borrowing money from the LIHEAP fund until we can pay it back, or are we just appropriating an additional $6 million, I guess would be the question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not completely sure how to answer the question, but...
Well, maybe I should ask the author of the bill. I thought you'd be right on top of that one, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, we are increasing the funds because there has not been an inflationary factor put on in buying more propane for energy assistance in the wintertime for a substantial amount of time. And if you want the exact date, she has it.
Just wanted to have that clarified. Thank you. Further questions for Representative Gunther or his witnesses? Anyone else want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. Members, since Representative Rood, our vice chair, is still not been called upon to present her bill in another committee, I'm going to pass her the gavel and go back to House File 1453 with the hope that we can get through that as fast as all of these other bills.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1453 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. What House File 1453 does is simply ask that a number of reports be made by public utilities. They're all simply listed on the bill in front of you, and I will ask Ms. Marshall to explain the rationale for having these reports made.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This will be the last time. The bill before you requires utilities to report information year-round that they currently report during the cold weather season alone. This bill also was included as part of last year's omnibus energy bill. There's really only one change, and that is to ask the utilities to also report the duration of service disconnections. This bill also is represents the consensus of the stakeholders, and to my knowledge, there is no opposition. As we've discussed today, service disconnections and customer arrearages are indications of customers' inability to pay for energy costs. When those costs increase, not surprisingly, customer arrearages and service disconnections also increase. We think that it's important to quantify the extent of the problem to ensure that policymakers and regulatory officials respond effectively. For example, right now we operate the energy assistance program as exclusively a heating program. And it may be, given some of the information that's tracked by this bill, that it makes some sense, obviously if funds are available, to run that program year-round. Tracking this information is also important to for securing additional federal funds. There are contingency funds that are appropriated along with the core LIHEAP funding each year in Congress. Those funds can be released anytime the state experiences an energy emergency. And in the federal law, an emergency does include a significant increase in home energy service disconnections reported by utilities. During the current cold weather rule period, as we said, this information is filed by the public utilities on a monthly basis to the commission. But it's also true about the cold weather rule period that the utilities are not disconnecting heat-affected service. The problem begins, and we see the increase in escalation in service disconnections after the cold weather rule ends, and we want to be able to quantify the extent of that problem.
Thank you. Are there any questions, members? Is there anybody who wishes to testify either in favor or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Hilty moves to recommend House File 1453 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion to bill.
Representative Gardner,
House File 2097.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2097, recommend to pass, and be placed on the general register.
Very well, Representative Gardner, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is very similar to Representative Saylor's bill, which applied to cooperatives and municipal utilities. This bill applies to public utilities and has some revisions on the cold weather rule. It would move some information which is on rules and puts them to statutes. I have to tell you that I read the original statute disconnection during cold weather, and it was about as clear as mud, so I think we're doing people a favor by being clear about what we're trying to do. The one of the main other things that it does is clarify that reconnections will happen and that utilities would notify people just before the cold weather period that they have the option to enter into a payment agreement and be reconnected, which has not always been the case. I don't think I'm going to beat you over the head with all of the issues here, but Representative Saylor did talk about the shutoff days as it applied to co-ops and munis, and the same clauses apply for public utilities. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, or I'm sure we don't need to have Mr. Elwood explain the bill either, but he's available for questions if we have any.
Any questions for Representative Gardner, as witness? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Chair. President Gardner, is there any reason why if the two bills are covering similar subjects that they're not combined? Any reason that it shouldn't be combined?
Well, I'm kind of wondering, also today, Mr. Chair, why and Representative Osmond, why we don't combine them all, but Mr. Elwood would be happy to answer that question.
Mr. Elwood. You don't look happy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Osmond, first I'd like to observe, apparently I've moved to the left since the last time I was here, but to the table. Are you saying why don't we put in an omnibus bill? Is that your question? Or why aren't we combining the muni and the co-op with the IOU bill? I'm not clear what your question is.
Representative Osmond.
Chair, let me restate. As when we start looking at the general register, it's really difficult to get bills an opportunity to be heard on the floor of the House. It might be best if you have similar subjects that we're actually joined together when possible. We can do that in this committee. It's a little more difficult after you leave the committee. I didn't know. But you can always put an amendment to do that on the floor also. But I was just wondering, is there a reason why they should not be combined? I guess is my question.
Mr. Holland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Osmond, I think the only reason is for just a procedural thing to keep the Senate and the House sort of moving along at the same pace, because yesterday all these bills were heard in the Senate and the Senate committee chose not to do it that way. I'm sure if you choose to do it that way, we can figure out a way to match them up on the other side. It's really your choice, and it's procedural, and that's it.
Mr. Chair, that answers my question. It's really up to the authors. I just want to know if there's a reason why they should not be combined. So,
Mr. Chair, and Representative Osmond, I would be more than happy to confer with some of my colleagues to work that out on the House floor and have them sewn up into one.
Further questions for the author or his witness? Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, thanks for the promotion. I would just like to mention, and first of all, thanks to Public Utilities Commission, and as well as the other utilities, as we have mentioned before, but I also want to thank the Public Utilities Commission and note that they've been very helpful in working with us on this bill. And they did point out some things that we would need to tweak. However, we just weren't able to get the amendment up, you know, the revisor and down for today's hearing. And, you know, the revisor obviously has been pretty overwhelmed these days. So I just want to put on the record that we're working with the PUC, and, of course, they're very interested in protecting consumers as well. And so you probably will see some slight changes if it comes to the floor the next time you see the bill. But it will be only improved at the suggestions of the Public Utilities Commission. I want to thank them again publicly.
Further questions? Representative Hackberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Gardner, I know that your bill's going to pass and we're not going to have much discussion on this, but I certainly would like to have a little bit of an explanation of what's really happening here. To me, it looks like we're rewriting the cold weather rule altogether and repealing, if that's what the repealer does, the old cold weather rule. And if we can have an explanation of what's really going on here, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hackforth, I had a chance to look at the, I don't know if the appendix is on all the copies that you have, but the old rule, or old statute is about, is pretty fuzzy. I had a hard time even reading it. And one thing we decided to do was just not do a line item edit on it because it would be so messy and just start over with another section. But Mr. Elwood can be clearer perhaps on this.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, well, first of all, putting it into a new section of law is simply because there were so many changes, it's just cleaner. So that's number one. But substantively, a lot of this is taking some of the existing PUC rules and putting it into the statute, and that's why the repealer, because you're seeing the rules that were in rules, now they're in statute. We think that the reason we're doing that primarily is because for most folks, especially folks are going to look for the statute. Rules are a little less accessible to folks. People look to the law, and we just felt it was easier to have everything spelled out very clearly in statute as opposed to having to go to the statute and then to the rules for further explication. The other, some of the changes were also part of the omnibus bill last year that, unfortunately, while the pieces that we had here were non-controversial, there were some other elements that became controversial, and as a result, there was no energy bill last year. So some of what you're seeing here, Representative Hackbarth, is what you've already seen last year and agreed to. I'm sure you don't remember those particular provisions, but I can assure you that they were there last year. They're being put in here. And then some of the same kinds of things that we're doing in the Muni and Co-op rule, we're doing here. I would point out two additional things that we are adding to this rule that are not currently in statute. One is that while we're retaining the cap of 10% on how much a customer's household income would be devoted to the payment under this bill, we are allowing, although not requiring, higher payments to be made if that's what the customer can afford and there's a mutual agreement between the customer and the utility. And the other thing that is being amended here that we don't currently have is a statutory provision that would allow payment agreements to be modified if during the period of that cold weather rule something changed. So if they were making a payment of X and all of a sudden somebody got sick or they had huge medical bills or they lost their job or whatever it might be, that they can come back to the utility and say, you know, we agreed to X, but here's what happened and I need to change it. And the utility seems to feel that that's reasonable. They like to work with their customers. And so I think what you're seeing here is a lot of what's in current law, but in current rules, I mean, but just it presented in, I think, a more readable, a more consumer, citizen-friendly manner.
Representative Hackbarth?
I'm good, thank you.
No further questions? Seeing none. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion for House File 2097 pass and be placed on the General Register.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to make a motion, I guess, this bill. Motion being?
I believe the motion would be that this bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on E-12 Education.
Yeah, thank you. That's what we talked about earlier. Thank you. This bill deals with wind power and school, some public school participation in that. And it's an existing law. I believe Representative Westrom, if needed, could shed some history on this. But 3.3 megawatts of nameplate capacity for wind can be constructed, acquired, owned in part or whole, operate, sell, retain, and spend the payment received from selling energy. So basically, it's wind. How much wind power can a school district be involved in? And just quick elementary math is that 3.3 megawatts is two 1.65 megawatt turbines, and that's the size of the turbine at the University of Minnesota Morris. This isn't for colleges, this is for public schools. Or that'd be two 1.5 megawatt turbines. Realizing that I believe it's called the Horizon Hills, or I'm not sure what the name of it is, but there's a new wind park going up in southern Minnesota, south, going to use 2.5 megawatt turbines made by Clipper. So, and then Suzlon, I believe, is making a 2 megawatt turbine. So the technology is getting bigger, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So this would allow you 4 2.5 megawatt turbines, 5 2 megawatt turbines, and this 1.65 turbine. You could have 6 of those, or you could have 6 of the 1.5 megawatt, say the GE 1.5 megawatt turbine. So these are the iterations as to what you could have. Because I believe there's a proposal from about 14 schools across the state right now, a wide geographic range, who are putting a plan together to develop a project using clean renewable energy bonds out of the federal government, which would then assist the utilities in meeting the RES that we passed, and also some of the desires for community-based energy development across the state, which school districts are eligible to participate in, bringing the total to 140 megawatts of wind that could be, you know, dealt with by 14 or so school districts in the state. Now, that's just the current plan that I've heard of, and the superintendent I've been dealing with wasn't able to make it here today to explain the origin of that plan. So I'm trying my best here. So that'd be like 56 2.5 megawatt turbines, and we've heard concerns in the committee and things about ordering the turbines, ordering more at one time, you know, those types of delivery issues and such, and harder to order less, you know, volume and those things dealing with supply and demand. So that's the proposal, and my proposal is to go to 10 above the from 3.3 to 10.
Questions for Representative Peterson. Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, it wasn't so many years ago we raised the 3.3 from, I believe it was 2.0. At the time it was, the concern is, why not just take the cap off? And the reason I think the legislature has at least done that in the past is said we embrace school districts who have different financing structures than private industry, et cetera, getting into this, mitigating their electricity costs, using it for science research display to the public. But my first reaction is 10 maybe gets us more into the business model of school districts going out and running a business versus using wind energy for their needs and for the other purposes I talked about. What's your thoughts of that? I'm just concerned with 10, it'll be 20 next year and 50, and do we just want to let schools get into the business of competing with all other developers as well and just see who wins, or... you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see your point. I believe we heard testimony the other night from Representative Magnus, you know, saying that, you know, between the, you know, 1980 and 2000, some of his counties that he represents lost 20% of their population. That has an impact on schools. I represent the least number of people of any representative in the state, and I represent parts of all the 12 school districts. You know, how do we allocate resources to schools across the state equitably, and with declining enrollment and lots of miles to cover? I represent a district, La Crosse Valley, that's 850 square miles, and there's as big ones, I believe, up northwest. Is this a way for them to take the pressure off some of the cuts to education, if you will? I think it would be. Is it fair? I'm not sure, but you don't need to have the wind. The thing is, you don't need to have this wind turbine on your school property. It doesn't need to be in the backyard by the football field. It could be in the best spot where you go out and partner with other communities and other, you know, interested utilities that have now standards to meet, and, you know, it would be such that you could get it up into a range where it might be of interest to make it more feasible for the project, to get it up into a range where it's a little bit bigger, a little more oomph, if you will. You know, it's still not every school district gets a 100 megawatt wind turbine project to make a ton of money and have a great school district, and then this one over here in Park Rapids doesn't get one. You know, it doesn't have to be on site. So the technology continues to get big. So, you know, I'm proposing 10. That would be four of the big ones.
Representative Wester?
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, and I mean, that's just kind of a number, and I understand. I mean, you have to pick a number.
Mm-hmm.
Is 10 significant for some reason of what somebody's proposing right now, or would 5 be a smaller incremental step? And secondly, to what you said, you're also saying that a school district under this current law, or 10 megawatts if we raise it to that, could also partner with a seabed project of 50 or 100 megawatts in an area and just be a partner owner in that as well. And I see that as another structure opportunity. But could 10 school districts go together and make a 100 megawatt project and be the entire seabed project? And I start thinking of that, and it somehow just doesn't strike me as exactly what we want to see for a variety of community-based ownership. Schools have different ways to finance it by going to the taxpayers, perhaps, and investors and entrepreneurs don't have that luxury. I don't know. Are we just, is there some issues that we maybe would not like to see come out of this? You see what I'm going?
Yeah, Representative Peterson. Yeah, I do agree with your approach to this. I'm wondering, I think the number should at least be an even number. It shouldn't be an odd number. You know, so maybe it's not 10. I don't think it should necessarily be 5, just the way that these turbines are being developed, 2.5, 2, 1.65, 1.5. You know, they're just, you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do. And that's where we came up with 3.3. Right. Somebody wanted two turbines that were 1.65, and the committee thought, well, you know, one or two isn't really that much difference, but I don't know. What do other people think? Maybe we want 10 school districts making a 100 megawatt project, and I'm just the only romantic view of spreading the opportunity. I don't know, Mr. Chair. I defer to what some other people's comments are before I suggest maybe changing the number.
Representative Western, Representative Kalin has a comment.
I do, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Westrum. I was actually going to speak to exactly that point, especially your last 10 school districts coming together to make a 100-megawatt project. Chisago Lake School District in my community is beginning a collaborative investment project down in southwestern Minnesota, and I actually didn't get the specific size how many megawatts they're going after in terms of their portion, and so I would just hesitate to change it anything other than 10 for now until we know more about the details of those sorts of agreements. And this is a district that's a couple hundred miles away from the wind, but actually doing some real innovative ways of saving some taxpayer money and hopefully doing some property tax relief at the same time. So I'd be happy to check back with our superintendent and school board and get back to you, Representative Westrum, and the author on how much they're buying into.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrum used a word I've never heard used in this committee before, and that was romance. And I'm glad he did. In fact, I'm glad he's here because it gives a chance to talk to you a little bit more about energy policy. And I think that this bill is even here at the moment because it was a romantic bill when it came up a couple years ago. I remember when this 3.3 discussion was had. It had little to do with policy and everything to do, I think, with romance. And I think that just my request of the members is that we wouldn't use our hearts quite so much, but we'd use our heads when we think about these things. And just to make one more point before I get to the policy question, I think it's pretty serious here. The fact that we're quibbling over a number, 3.3 versus 10, is because we're in a dynamic industry, just like telecommunications, where technology is changing faster than we can react to it. Folks, we're legislators. We should be casting bigger policy and allowing technology to move as the market demands it and as the technology can accommodate good things for humankind. So anyhow, is this a national crisis here today? No, it's not. But it is to somebody who's kind of a policy wonk in this stuff, kind of amusing that we're back here quibbling over 3.3 or 10 or where the latest turbine's going to be, because I bet you, Representative Peterson, we have no idea where the turbines are going to be tomorrow. In fact, somebody handed out a fascinating little sheet here a few moments ago about compression and storing air so we can actually solve the dispatchability problem that we have. And I think that's an electrifying, no pun intended, handout that we need to be paying attention to.
That came from you, Representative Greer. Thank you for mentioning it. I forgot to mention it.
Well, Chair Hilty, thank you for bringing that up. At a wind conference a couple years ago in South Dakota, a Danish scientist approached me after I was complaining about the dispatch problem. He cornered me with this idea, and actually people are doing this. But anyhow, I've digressed. Back to the issue at hand, and it's one called risk and reward. I think the automatic assumption here, and again, I think it's based in a romantic notion that we put up a windmill and dollars flow to the people who are lucky enough to get them, is a romantic notion that ignores the fact that in business there is also a risk side of things. And we manage that well for benefits, particularly when we're dealing with school district money, which I think is a fiduciary process, for pensions and things like that. And there may be a reason there was a fence built around school districts owning this. It had little to do with unfair competitive advantage to private capital. It had everything to do with protecting the financial integrity of school districts, because these things do break down from time to time. In fact, you want to go out and visit my dad, I can show you thousands of acres of dead windmills standing in the Altamont Pass that aren't doing anything except waiting for a scrapper to take them down. These things happen. It's not romantic to think about that side of things, but Representative Peterson, when you go to Ed Finance, you may want to have somebody think that through or have that policy discussion there, because it's probably better suited there, Mr. Chair, than in this committee. That from time to time, things do go haywire, and somebody ends up eating a windmill and taking a financial bath. And that may be one thing we want to consider before we pass this on. Seriously, I'm asking that you consider that.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Peter. Yeah, those are intriguing thoughts. But I do know is that I believe in 2005, wind power increased 25% a lot around the world, and then last year I think there was like $40 billion done around the world, and a lot of it was in India and in China. And I do know that it's getting bigger, and it's the fastest growing energy. New energy source in the world. So it's here to stay, and it's here to get bigger, I think. How big will it actually get? You know, that's a function of, you know, transportation. Where is it going to be made? You know, how wide is the township road where the wind is the best? That type of thing. You know, are the railroad bridges high enough to get the stuff through the tunnel? You know, yeah, there's a lot of mechanics and logistics that might limit size. But it continues to go up, and I think it's safe to say 2.5 megawatt turbine is, you know, supposed to be constructed, and they plan to use it in southern Minnesota here, you know, getting them made out of Iowa. So, you know, I understand your concern to a certain extent, but 3.3, I believe, is limiting.
Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Peterson, I agree that the limitations that are currently in statute make it difficult to know if it's going to fit the potential that we have out there. Taking into account exactly what Representative Beard is raising in with regard to concerns, I'm wondering, instead of trying to regulate the amount of electricity or the size of the units, if we shouldn't be looking at discussing what is the appropriate level of risk that we should authorize school districts to be involved in, as we don't want them to get into the business of creating energy to the point that they start to sacrifice their ability to provide education. And if there's something does go wrong, that's kind of what's at risk. So I'm wondering if there has been any discussion in the past, or maybe we should at least start to initiate that now, even though we can change this for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
But for future times, because this is something that's going to continue to grow. This isn't
correct.
And the benefit, the people are going to focus on the benefits, and they're not going to pay attention to the business side of it and the risk side of it until something goes wrong. And then they're going to say, whoa, we didn't realize that was going to happen. So maybe we should be doing both, instead of looking down the road of continuing to just up the ante with regard to the megawatts, we start to focus on how much should a school district, you know, be putting at risk? And this may not be the right committee to even discuss that, but I think that's one that we should encourage other committees to take a look at. so that we can allow them to have those options of joining in with other school districts. Why focus on the megawatts when, man, if they can join together and they could have a sizable number of megawatts, but yet have their personal or individual risk of the school district be kept small. And so I would encourage those types of thoughts in the long term.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Representative Osner, if I may, and I'll shut it down. But, you know, 1.8, line 1.8, in own in whole or in part. So I believe they would have an arrangement, like most of these developments do, for a operation and maintenance plan, a warranty plan, a risk management plan, a financeable project. There's a lot of experts out there who know how to do this and help this, you know, help the district, I guess, with these clean renewable energy bonds that, you know, the federal government makes available at a certain amount, authorizes at least, and then schools are able to get basically zero interest money to join into the project, but they can't just have it all and take all of the risk, you know, losing all of their per pupil funding or their sparsity aid or their special education dollars, that type of thing. I think it's what maybe you might want to call decoupled. I'm not sure if that's the correct term, but they're firms that will manage risk.
Romantic,
as part romantic decoupling. There we go.
Somehow, I don't think that's within the purview of this committee.
And with that, throughout the will of the committee, but I'd appreciate to go see what Chair Mariani thinks of this idea.
Representative Taylor would like to weigh in on this. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just would, in response to Representative Westrum and some other comments, kind of agree with Representative Osmond, perhaps, and encourage us to look beyond the scope of this committee. And fund our schools adequately in the first place, because I doubt very much if the schools are really truly very interested in getting into the wind business, but I know that they're really truly interested in figuring out how to pay for their power. And, but then we could maybe have the 3.3 megawatt that indeed was addressing science projects and those sorts of things. So I would just encourage us all to look beyond this committee for that, and maybe we wouldn't be addressing bills like this here. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Western.
Mr. Chair, as I'm listening, Representative Peterson, would you consider maybe a sunset of 5 years or something that then would bring this back to us to discuss and we can see what's this done? Is that an option that would be amenable at all? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Western, I don't think it is, because the power purchase agreements on these projects last a lot longer than 5 years.
And I'm just talking not somebody that's already in existence. Oh. After 5 years, if we didn't renew it or extend this or change the number again, school districts would have, that wanted to get into it, wouldn't be able to get into it. If they haven't gotten into it in 5 years, per se, they would have to have us change the legislation or renew it to allow them to have it. The only reason I'm thinking maybe that's the way to go is it forces some review, and it does bring it back to the legislature, so other districts that see a neighboring district that got into this, that wants to start into it, would look at the law and say, hey, we need you to extend it, but we would also, as legislators, review it and say, has this all been beneficial and no liabilities, or has there been some unforeseen consequences? Just a thought.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe that since the public schools in the state of Minnesota, the Department of Education would have all of that financial information coming through them, which would be the Department of, we could ask the Department of Education, an interested legislator who wants to know could ask the Department of Education, just how is this working? I think that would be, I think, appropriate and already existing activity that the Department of Education would have that mission.
Members, another committee is scheduled to occupy this room in about 3 minutes. I think a number of really good points have been made about this bill, Representative Peterson, Representatives Westrum and Beard and Osmond have, I think, all raised very good questions, and I think we should keep in mind Representative Osmond's observation that Probably most of the questions that have been raised in this committee are more appropriately addressed in the Education Committee, and I would presume, although this is being referred to the Policy Committee, that it would also go to Education Finance, since it clearly has financial implications for any school district that would be involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
Members, I would suggest that we do pass this bill on to Education and let them deal with it. And Representative Peterson, I trust that you will keep these points in mind and hopefully find a way of addressing them with the appropriate committee.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the advice and direction. I will hopefully go to Representative Mariani shortly here, and then I will discuss with him if I get a hearing on the bill to go to Education Finance.
Thank you. And with that, would you wish to renew your motion?
Renew my motion that 1642 recommended to pass and refer to Education Policy.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Kalin, I had hoped we could squeeze your bill into the agenda today, but obviously we're not going to be able to do that, and we will take it up on Monday. Members, with that, the meeting is adjourned.